The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, podcast listeners. Wittis here. Brief note, we need to spread the word about the podcast. That's your job. We don't have an advertising budget. We just have you. So get on it. Tweet it. Do what you have to do. Make yourself really annoying to your friends. I do this. Share us on Facebook. Write glowing reviews on iTunes that express your undying adoration of the Lawfare podcast. I want to see Instagram photos of you guys listening to the podcast. I want it on Reddit. I want the podcast to be hitting me from where I don't even know it's going to come. Thanks.
One of my biggest concerns in this use of targeting strategy in non-war zones is that there's been a deafness to the broader political impact and a failure to think through the political consequences. And ultimately, terrorism is a political threat.
Right.
It's not easily ended through strictly using any kind of force. You have to have a broader political strategy to be successful. But the other thing I wanted to add is that we have to remember that targeting is not one causal variable without other things that also impact a group.
Right.
And it's also not one unique thing that doesn't have other aspects of counterterrorism. When thinking about whether or not to target a leader, you have to consider the question, compared to what? I mean,
right.
We have decades of history where leaders were also captured or members of a group were also captured, and the information that was gathered as a result of capturing or gaining access to where they are in a less lethal way was far more important than the killing of any individual.
I'm Jennifer Williams, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 4th, 2014. That's the voice of Audrey Kurth Cronin, Distinguished Service Professor at the School of Policy, Government, and International Affairs at George Mason University, and the author of the book, How Terrorism Ends. I spoke with Audrey about her recent piece on Lawfare's foreign policy essay on the current state of the U.S. war on terrorism, the fight against Al-Qaeda and its affiliate organizations, and the struggle against the group known as the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. We discussed the Obama administration's increased reliance on drones as its primary counterterrorism tactic and the implications this has for the long-term effectiveness of U.S. counterterrorism efforts. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 94, Audrey Kurth Cronin on the State of the War on Terrorism.
Your recent piece for the foreign policy essay on Lawfare is titled, Is This How to Win the War on Terrorism? So I'd like to have you just start by giving us an overview of the piece, what your piece is about, what the basic arguments are, and then we can kind of get down into the nitty-gritty of it.
Sure, Jen. I've been following terrorism for quite a long time, and nothing that I'm about to say is meant to minimize the threat of terrorism, nor minimize the importance of counterterrorism. Both things are very important, and a lot of my prior writings argue that this is an important area for us to focus on. But what has concerned me is that we defined our conflict with Al-Qaeda shortly after September 11th as a war. And in doing so, we set in motion a number of things that made it very difficult for us to build an end to that war. And so here we are all these years later, and we don't really have a concept of what it means to be at peace. So because we've defined this conflict in war terms, and also because we passed an authorization for the use of military force that continues to be the major argument for the use of force against jihadist groups, not just al-Qaeda now.
Right.
I'm very concerned about some of the classic things that have kicked into place for the United States. And these are the typical things that happen to states that are involved in a very long war. Particularly, means start to look like ends. We get very, very focused on those means. Tactics take the place of strategy. We're not looking at the overall picture. And all sense of boundary begins to be lost. A lot of the prior framework that we were accustomed to before September 11th is now either strained or rewritten or non-existent. And then finally, the search for a perfect peace with no risk to Americans has replaced any concept of reality. So my piece is a cautionary note about the dangers of open-ended war, even when it comes to fighting something as serious as terrorism.
Thank you. Great. Now, as you probably know, Lawfare folks are particularly interested in the issue of unmanned aerial vehicles, or of course drones. I know in your piece you discuss how means become ends, how tactics have driven strategy. So, and you talk about how the administration's increased reliance on drones as basically the primary counterterrorism tool has created a situation in which tactics are now driving strategy. So if you could maybe elaborate on that point, particularly on what you see as the downside to using drones as maybe not just a counterterrorism tool, but the primary counterterrorism tool, and, you know, what strategy we should be pursuing rather than just letting drones be the kind of primary tool.
Sure. I'm really talking about armed drones, so not all drones. Drones are becoming ubiquitous, and I think that the use of robotics in many, many different settings in the United States and throughout the world is going to become increasingly common. So armed drones, and I'm also specifically talking about the use of armed drones in places where we are not officially at war. So when you integrate the use of armed drones with any kind of military operation, that's kind of a ho-hum to me. That's just one more way of using force. So I was specifically concerned in this piece and also in my other writings, in a foreign affairs piece, a couple other things, about the degree to which we're relying upon armed drones in going into places with which we're not officially at war to target leaders. And I've written a lot about the pros and cons of targeting leadership. And my real concern there is that we're so focused on making progress against al-Qaeda and its associates, particularly with the use of armed drones in places like Pakistan and the frontier zone, Yemen, Somalia, that we're not thinking about the broader impact upon the movement. There are certain conditions under which killing the leadership actually makes terrorism less threatening and can draw a group to its close, and none of those conditions are met, in my opinion, with the jihadist movement. So although some terrorist attacks have been prevented and the use of armed drones has been a factor in that, I think they've been used far too often and have been relied upon far too heavily, where a lot of other thinking has been lacking.
Thank you. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you more specifically on the leadership targeting issue. We actually have a piece coming out this coming Sunday on leadership targeting. Austin Long will be talking about his argument is that leadership targeting can have decisive results when it depends on institutionalization as the factor he looks at, whether they have a deep bench and are able to rapidly replace leaders. I know in your work, you've talked about specifically that historically that the terrorist organizations that have been successfully defeated using leadership targeting were tended to be hierarchically structured, young, characterized by a cult of personality and lacking a viable successor. So it seems that kind of especially the viable successor part seems to be similar to that other argument. You said that ISIS or al-Qaeda or the jihadist movement in general doesn't fit that model. Could you talk maybe more about that specifically, especially with ISIS and what we're now doing in terms of airstrikes, targeting leaders, and also the al-Qaeda and the affiliates?
Sure. Actually, ISIS is a different case because ISIS is more of a traditional insurgency now, in almost a conventional army, and it occupies territory. And I wouldn't say that a lot of the research that we do specifically on terrorist groups that leverage their effects applies directly to ISIS in the same way. Okay. So I would really draw a distinction because they have now evolved into something that's not strictly a terrorist group. They use terrorism. But when you're talking about Al-Qaeda and the groups that it spawned, I think there were two problems. The first was that Al-Qaeda was never – it never fit the kind of characteristics of a group that would end with the use of targeting. It, for the reasons that you described, Jen, because we saw it unfold. I mean, we saw strike after strike of – usually it was the number three leader who kept being replaced and replaced.
Right.
I don't know how many people were in the number three spot. But the second side of my concern there was that we started to target lower and lower operatives within the Al-Qaeda movement. And it almost began to be search for something to hit.
Right.
Rather than concern about how best to have a strategic effect on Al-Qaeda. So they were going, down and targeting relatively low-level folks because the number of attacks increased tremendously. And that was losing sight of the overall effect that this campaign was having. It was actually causing a great deal of political backlash for the United States. One of my biggest concerns in this use of targeting strategy in non-war zones is that there's been a deafness to the broader political impact and a failure to think through the political consequences. And ultimately, terrorism is a political threat.
Right.
It's not easily ended through strictly using any kind of force. You have to have a broader political strategy to be successful. But the other thing I wanted to add is that we have to remember that targeting is not one causal variable without other things that also impact a group.
Right.
And it's also not one unique thing that doesn't have other aspects of counterterrorism. You know, when thinking about whether or not to target a leader, you have to consider the question, compared to what? I mean,
right.
We have decades of history where leaders were also captured or members of a group were also captured, and the information that was gathered as a result of capturing or gaining access to where they are in a less lethal way was far more important than the killing of any individual. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that the fact that bin Laden, although he was killed by a special operation, the fact that his huge trove of documentation and computer hard drives was captured was in some senses more important to the overall fight against Al-Qaeda.
Do you think that you would have preferred, obviously, if it was a life or death situation and they had to fire back, but do you think it would have been better if they were able to capture bin Laden, even given, the actual tactical realities on the ground in terms of intelligence usage? Would you think he would have been a good asset to be able to get any intelligence, or do you think that would have just been a complete dead end?
Well, fortunately, we weren't faced with that choice because
right.
it would have been very difficult to know where exactly to hold him.
Right.
That would have had its own problems. I think there are leaders whose death does have a salutary effect on a broader campaign, and I
right.
think, of course, bin Laden was one of those. But we're not just talking about the death of bin Laden. We're talking about the death of hundreds of other folks
right.
who occupy various positions from low to high. We've had a very broad campaign of using armed drones. And I think in some cases and in some situations, particularly when we've hit civilians or when we've been manipulated by governments on the ground who are the ones who provide us the intelligence, we've ended up making some mistakes.
Right, definitely. Thank you. Now, speaking of leadership targeting and some of the other strategies, I know in your work you've laid out, I think, six pathways and how terrorist groups have ended. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but the six pathways that you identified looking historically at how terrorist groups have ended were, as we said, leadership targeting, negotiations, success, so the terrorists achieve their strategic goals, failure, so they implode because of factionalization or infighting or they lose the popular support. And they kind of have to lay down arms or they all get arrested, would be repression, would be the next one. So massive crack down military or police force, whether it's an outside force like the United States coming in, or in Egypt, like in the 1990s with Al-Gama al-Islamiyah and al-Jihad with the repression by the Mubarak regime. And then finally, reorientation. So basically getting them to transition either away and towards more just standard criminal behavior, or like you've, I guess we've seen with ISIS, becoming more a traditional insurgency, or even just a full-fledged, you know, war, conventional war force. So in terms of al-Qaeda and its affiliates, if leadership targeting isn't necessarily the best strategy, or not by itself with al-Qaeda, what do you see as, I mean, among those different ways? Obviously, we don't want success to be the way that they end.
That's not possible.
I don't think that's going to work. And, you know, negotiations, I think they've made pretty clear. I know Zawahiri has stated repeatedly, you know, there is no negotiation.
And that's
there
also not possible. Yes.
Right. So in terms of what options are left, what do you think would be the best kind of strategy to pursue over the long term?
Sure. Well, just to review the ones that we've ruled out, negotiations are absolutely an abhorrent idea with the core of al-Qaeda. Nobody
right.
would ever suggest those. But in some cases, some of the groups that have aligned with al-Qaeda have local aims that are at least are longstanding and predate
right.
al-Qaeda and are more related to nationalist interests. So on a case-by-case basis, looking at local situations where al-Qaeda has essentially hijacked longstanding grievances, there we have to think about what those grievances are. And in some cases, working with local actors and with local governments, that may involve negotiating or at least talking to groups. I think the Indonesians, for example,
right.
and their relationship with Jamaah Islamiyah, they've been quite subtle in how they've handled the threat of terrorism there. So it's hard to make generalizations about all groups that are associated with al-Qaeda when it comes to negotiations. But certainly core al-Qaeda and the major affiliates, the most dangerous affiliates, AQAP, AQIM, and so on, no negotiations are
right.
possible. That, we can rule that one right out. And as for success, my research demonstrates that the number of groups that are actually successful over the many decades I studied, that in fact hundreds of groups, I looked at almost 500 groups,
wow.
Success is only possible in about 6%, 5-6% of the cases. So success is very rare. But two pathways that I think have been feasible for al-Qaeda and have been making this argument for years are either to implode because they are actually quite an extreme and marginalized ideology
right.
To generate a backlash and also to lose public support of their group. And by the way, this is also a major concern for Zawahiri and had been before him
right.
for bin Laden, because there was significant loss of popular support that occurred between about 2007 and recent years. Al-Qaeda is not a popular group.
Right.
So implosion was the first pathway that I was hoping that we would go down, and we've seen some dynamics of implosion for al-Qaeda. But the other pathway that I thought was possible was reorientation of al-Qaeda to a stronger kind of force. And I very much fear that ISIS is a symptom of that kind of reorientation. This gets us back to what you asked me in the outset, you know, what is ISIS? You know, ISIS has distinguished itself and also argued that it is more important and more prominent than al-Qaeda. They're not associates, at least according to ISIS's point of view.
Right.
But they have taken this bizarre, twisted ideology and turned it into a broader, more traditional kind of conventional insurgency-type threat. And that is a very bad development.
Just kind of on that point, I'm wondering, and this is something I've kind of been discussing with other people recently, in terms of the fighters that are being attracted to ISIS and the kind of distinction that scholars like to make and al-Qaeda leadership and ISIS leadership like to make between their two groups, I'm wondering if you're seeing that the fighters who are going, if they're actually distinguishing between the two groups, or if it's kind of this broader jihadist ideology and this broader project that they're kind of attracted to, are they just attracted to ISIS because they're successful and this is the place to go? Or do they, I guess, do they think that, or do you think that they think that the Al-Qaeda project has failed, the kind of far enemy strategy, kind of waiting in the shadows and attacking, you know, here and there where you can versus taking and holding territory? Or do you think they're just going to fight jihad because it's fun and it's an adventure and ISIS is successful?
Well, you're going to find individuals who fit all those categories. Right. So it's hard to make generalizations. But I think the fact that ISIS has been successful is a huge drawing card. There's also, let's look back at what happened with the Syrian civil war. There were a large number of people who came, particularly from European countries,
right,
who wanted to fight the Assad regime and, you know, wanted to be a part of what were, you know, admirable ideals in terms
Certainly.
Of finding greater freedoms within that country. And many of those people came to Syria, sometimes ill-equipped, ill-trained, not speaking the language, being
right.
quite naive. And many of the groups have been struggling. And so there's been an attraction to going along with ISIS and to some extent Nusra, mm-hmm. But especially lately ISIS, because it's a winner. And
right.
it's a place that actually has a lot of resources. It can pay people.
Mm-hmm.
It can provide for their needs as well as give them the kinds of weapons that they feel they want to use in order to be effective. So I think the fact that it is a winner is a major element in this. But we're coming out of the history of the last couple of years in the Syrian civil war, and that's
right.
also a key element.
Definitely. I think in terms of, the pathway to ending kind of Al-Qaeda in general, I guess what kind of concerns me is that if we're talking about implosion, we're talking about losing legitimacy and losing the support of the population with the rise of the popularity of ISIS. Again, it's still obviously fairly marginal in terms of the wider Muslim community, but you do see this kind of resurgence in excitement, or at least on social media. So I'm wondering if this is kind of thrown a speed bump in the path towards Al-Qaeda imploding. And what does that mean for the future of counterterrorism efforts and for that strategy? Do you think that strategy is still viable in terms of them losing legitimacy and support?
Well, again, I would distinguish between Al-Qaeda and the
right.
longer-term strategy against Al-Qaeda and ISIS.
Right.
With respect to Al-Qaeda, there are two things. The first one is that I think we actually have had a significant amount of success undermining their ideology and their attractiveness. And one of the reasons why Al-Qaeda is doing relatively worse compared to ISIS and was long before ISIS and al-Baghdadi gained all of this attention
mm-hmm.
Relates to the fact that there has been a natural repulsion to the kind of violence that Al-Qaeda was using, targeting civilians, causing many of their the actual targets and recipients of their violence to be the very people that they're wanting to attract.
Right.
The Muslim populations in Muslim-majority countries have not been in large numbers attracted to Al-Qaeda.
Definitely.
But the other side of it is that there's now a concerning dynamic where groups like Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, which continues to have quite sophisticated capabilities and is continuing to be very focused on the West and on the United States, there is a concern that they will actually try to regain some momentum
right.
and carry out an attack. I don't think we should minimize that concern. I think that's a serious concern, even though we're all focused on ISIS. So when it comes to the second part of your question, what's the best way to approach ISIS? I don't think that especially in the short term, implosion is going to be the answer. You have a group that has oriented itself, reoriented, or arrived on the scene
right.
as a kind of a more traditional military force, and
right.
so you have to take more traditional military measures. And I think that we are doing so, but the measures that are most important are those that come from within the region.
Right.
There's a tendency for us to think about ISIS in the same U.S. ISIS framework that we had a tendency to think about Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
It's extraordinarily self-focused and egocentric and, I think, counterproductive, because the threat of ISIS is greatest to those people who are in the territories that ISIS is holding first.
Absolutely.
And then in concentric circles outside of those people to actors within the region who are heavily threatened by the vision and by the capabilities of ISIS. So in developing our military response, the fact that we have Jordan, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and even Qatar involved in answering the threat of ISIS is far more important than, at least in the public eye, than the American answer to ISIS. This is a threat to the region.
Definitely. I'd like to actually switch a little bit and shift gears. I want to talk about, as egocentric as it may be, U.S. counterterrorism efforts. But specifically in your piece, you talked about the bloated counterterrorism bureaucracy that kind of grew up after 9/11. I know the Washington Post did a lot of work, really great work on that, kind of tracking how it's exploded, for lack of a better word, after 9/11. I'd like for you, if you could explain a bit more about that, about what you see, that how that grew out of 9/11 and the development of the threat, and also why you see that as something negative for counterterrorism.
Oh, I'm not sure it's negative for counterterrorism. I mean, I guess it is in the longer term in a strategic sense.
Right.
But let's recall that the United States has a lot of interests in addition to counterterrorism. I'm a counterterrorism expert. That is something that it's hard for me to get to the point to say, but I think we are at that point.
Right.
I was arguing that we needed greater counterterrorism capabilities. We built those capabilities, and then we went overboard. I mean, it's as if there were no limitations to what we were trying to do. We reorganized or built something like 1,000 new government organizations. There are at least 2,000 private organizations. The figures are all in my writings, but also in the research that has been done by the Washington Post. We have a tremendous intelligence structure. We have extraordinarily increased our special operations capabilities. All of these things were needed in the aftermath of 9/11, but now it's a matter of degree. And we're beginning to crowd out, not least because we can see no end to this war, no concept of peace. We're beginning to be at the point where we're pouring so much talent, not just resources, but talent and attention and media focus and political capital into counterterrorism that we're beginning to undermine ourselves.
I know you speak. You spoke in your piece about all of the thousands of intelligence reports that are being produced, and that it's great that everyone's looking and paying attention. But how many people do we have who are actually reading all of those reports, and are things getting missed? So, at what point do you think it's time to? I mean, I guess you think we're at that point. It's time to kind of scale it back. I just wonder. I guess my question is more along the lines of, in terms of U.S. public opinion, I know you talk about in your piece also that, zero risk of terrorism is a fantasy, and that a key element, you said, in winning is building psychological resilience among the American public so that they're less subject to manipulation by threats of attacks. And I certainly agree. I think that's a fantastic suggestion. My only concern is in terms of practical policy standpoint, it's kind of difficult for me to imagine, a politician running on less counterterrorism spending and just get used to more attacks. So in terms of kind of a broader policy implications of that, how do we go about, toning down the rhetoric, but also, getting people to understand that no matter how much we spend, sometimes terrorism is just going to happen and terrorist attacks are going to happen because of who we are?
Well, that's a very complicated question, and there are a lot of things that strike me to say in response. The first one is that we're a great power. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have to go out there and say, we want less counterterrorism spending, or you're going to get hit by a terrorist attack. That would be stupid and foolish, and, I'm not a politician, but I'm smart enough to know that that's not a good
right,
approach.
Right, right.
But great leadership involves understanding that there are risks in the world. As a great power, we, like every great power before us, we are going to be targeted. We understood that before September 11th, to a greater extent than we do now. We have actually been trying to, in our war on terrorism, trying to convince the American people that they deserve somehow to have zero risk of terrorism.
Right.
And that is completely impossible. And then we help the threat. We actually give it more legitimacy by some of the kinds of reactions that we've heard in the aftermath of the ISIS killing, the tragic beheading of the two American journalists, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Having leaders go out before the public and say that this involves every single one of American interests, this is World War III unfolding, that the ISIS is going to be killing us on the streets of the United States, I recall. ISIS is going to be coming across the Mexican border. What kind of leadership is that? Leaders are meant to direct the public toward productive ways of thinking. And so we have been in situations where we have had existential threats. We have been – we have fought a civil war. I mean, I don't want to be pedantic here, but, you know, it's kind of obvious. I think the American people realize that this is not the same as the threat of the Nazis, for example.
Or the Cold War.
Or the Cold War, where we could be obliterated four or five times, seven or eight times over. ISIS doesn't have those capabilities. Can it develop a desire and a capability and a sophistication to hit the United States at some point in the future? Absolutely. Nobody can rule that out. But let's get some balance in the message here. I think it's a matter of not giving in to feeding the anxiety of the American people in the post-September 11th years of having a broader concept of leadership.
Thank you. And I know at the same time it's also difficult because, you know, for those of us in the counterterrorism fields, we definitely don't want to downplay the threat because we got to make sure that we're still paying attention. So I guess it's hard to find that kind of happy medium by reminding the public we still need funding for counterterrorism projects and, you know, the threat's not gone. But at the same time, you don't want to, you know, use the kind of hyperbole we've been seeing, like coming over the Texas-Mexico border. I'm from Texas, so I've seen some of those reports. Some of them are quite laughable. But I guess, do you think that there's a potential to swing too far the other way? Or do you think that because of the bureaucracy that has grown up, we're probably okay for now in terms of downplaying the threat?
Well, I think that anyone who studies terrorism or counterterrorism learns very early on that the stupidest thing you could ever do is say that there is no risk. And objectively speaking, of course there's a risk. But unfortunately, we're replacing what is in American interests with a desire to avoid being a scapegoat. I would only put it in a personal way. I've been studying counterterrorism for a long time. This is a very important threat and has been for a long time. But I'm an American first. A counterterrorism expert is a distant second. It's in the interest of our country to regain some balance. And I think we can do that even as we recognize that there is some risk.
Well, thank you. I think that's a fantastic place to stop. So thank you again so much for speaking with me today.
I enjoyed it, Jen.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is, as always, performed by Sophia Yan. We need your help spreading the word about the Lawfare Podcast. Tweet it. Share it on Facebook. Rate it and leave reviews on whatever podcast distribution service you use. Do your part to bring us to new audiences. Thanks for listening.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.